drinking your own wee-wee. But that's not my wee-wee, I sputter. You're correct, he answers with pride. It's mine. I retch. I'm healthier than you, he says, shrugging without concern. You should be thanking my bladder, not complaining. I can't believe I just drank this hippie freak's piss. I continue to gag as he drives along, looking at me in food pity. You poor thing, he tisks. It's all those animal parts stuck in your veins that are making you sick. Bristle. You know what that is? No, I admit weakly. That's stiff animal hair left over on pork products. Gag. Don't be puking in my car, he warns, and if you do, I would expect you to eat it back up. Consuming one's own vomit is a way to train your digestive system to reject animal-derived substances. Please, I beg, do you have anything a little less radical to eat? He thinks a minute. Sure. You like tofu? Yes, I yell, practically salivating for something I've at least enjoyed in my culinary past. Here you go, he offers, taking out a bowl made out of a recycled tin can. It's raw, the way tofu should be eaten. I scarf it down. He is listening to the ridiculously childish novelty tune, Tofurkey Song, by Joni Leeds. But I can tell he sees no humor in the chorus. Wobble, 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 not gobble, gobble, gobble. What do I care? At least the recording covers up the sudden rumbling in my stomach. We continue to drive, and much to my humiliation, I fart. Eugene looks over at me and says with a straight face, reject that suet. What is suet, I ask, anything to divert my embarrassment. The solid fat prepared from the kidneys of cattle, he deadpans. Suddenly, a blast of shit fires in my pants without warning. The stench is overpowering. Oh, God, I think he's going to expect me to eat this? That's what you get from eating meat, he scolds with a savage new fanaticism. I have food poisoning, I will. Why didn't you cook that tofu? Cooking is a violation of the natural order of food, you fool, he lectures with an obnoxiously patronizing tone. Please pull over, I plead. Absolutely not, he answers. You have to learn a lesson about excrement. Your bowels are sending you a vegan message. Oh, they're not, I scream in mortification. I have diarrhea. Please let me stop at a restroom. I bet you have wiping issues, Eugene suddenly accuses me. What are you talking about, I argue in building delirium, as another mudslide of shit blasts out and trickles down my pant leg. You're nuts, I yell. I'm sick. Pull over. I'm nuts, he barks. Me? The healthiest man you've ever met? Do you know what I'm going to die from? He rants like the fascist he is. Nothing. That's what I'm going to die from. Nothing. With that, he veers off Route 70 and pulls into a family rest stop. McDonald's, Pizza Hut, the whole nightmare of fast food right before my eyes. He slams on the brakes and the scabs on my knees break apart. The seatbelt cuts into my infected tattoo and a final logjam of liquid turds detonates out back. You were born under the astrological sign of feces, meat pig, and you will die under that sign, Eugene spits out in final judgment. Now excrete from my car. I do. I walk through the parking lot and the whole world can see I have shit my pants. Hey, shithead, some brat of a kid yells as both his parents hold their nose and laugh. They don't make eye contact, but just make a beeline for the men's room. I walk through the packed food court, gagging and farting every time I see or smell food. Wouldn't you know it, the bathroom is crowded. All the stalls are filled. Oh, my God, some man mutters in disgust when he sees my sorry state of affairs. Out of the corner of my eyes, I notice men stopping in their tracks and then scattering in horror. Finally, a stall opens and a college student type exiting makes direct eye contact with me. John Waters, he cries in surprised happiness. Yes, I stupidly answer, pushing past him and slamming the door shut behind me. Oh, my God, I hear him yell to just about everybody. Did you see that? That was John Waters. I'm almost certain he has shit his pants. I hear grown men laugh in constipated smugness and digestive superiority. I hang my jacket on the inside hook and plop my chafed ass down on the toilet, but there is nothing left to come out. I attempt to clean myself up. It was hard outside to take off both my underpants and pants, but here in a rest area men's room, it's downright scary. I'm sure bathroom users can see me bottomless through the cracks in the stall door. I roll up my disgusting boxer shorts to ditch upon leaving. I flush a couple of times and use the clean toilet water to wash out my pants. I'm on my hands and knees scrubbing the cloth with all my might, It's a good thing I wasn't wearing white jeans as I usually do in the summer. I flush over and over until someone yells, "You okay in there, buddy?" I freeze. "Yes, I'm fine," I lie, rinsing out my Levi's one last time and hoping they will dry quickly once I'm out in the sun. Just as I turn around to face the daunting task of slipping into my wet pants, I see a hand come over the top of the stall, quick as lightning, and grab my jacket. "Hey, fucker," I yell as I trip over my boots, struggling to get one leg into my sopping jeans. "Stop! Thief!" I shout, but all I hear back is the footsteps of the running jacket snatcher. "Someone just stole my coat," I scream, but for once, the bathroom seems empty. I run out of the booth in my stocking feet, still zipping up my fly, but all I see is a father and son walking in, eyeing me with alarm. "Did you see somebody run out with my jacket?" I ask, completely beside myself. "How would I know what your jacket looks like?" the father asks with rude sarcasm. "Yeah, moron," spits out the kid to me as I stuff my feet in my unlaced hiking boots and race past them, depositing my diarrhea underpants in the trash can right in front of their suddenly scared, shitless eyes. I run through the rest area with my laces flapping, tripping over them every few steps. "Thief!" I yell, but people look away, and I don't see a security guard in sight. Once outside in the parking lot, I realize whoever swiped my jacket is long gone. No jacket, no bag, no phone. I'm really alone. In St. Louis, for shit's sake. Bad ride number 6, Woody. At least there's an entrance ramp back onto I-70 West, my supposed lifeline for this misadventure. Maybe a freshly fed fat family from the food court will have mercy and pick me up. I stand with my thumb out for over 2 hours, but I don't mind because I'm praying the wind is acting as a deodorizer of my fecal accident. Suddenly, I spot a discarded can of Off insect repellent in the weeds near where I'm standing. I leap over and grab it and spray it all over me. Off is not a real deodorant, but I've always loved the exclamation point included in the brand name. And besides, I don't have any toiletries left. This will have to do. Even the Maybelline eye pencil I keep in my sports jacket pocket is now gone. I pick up a cigarette butt from the roadside gravel and, without a mirror, from memory, try to shade in my graying signature facial hair. Who knows if I colored within the lines. For once, I do want to be recognized. I can use all the help my look can muster. Naturally, the next ride's driver has no idea who I am, but I learn way too much about him immediately. Straining to hear his braggart opinions over the most obnoxious, screaming talk radio shows that he violently changes back and forth by pushing the channel button so hard I'm amazed they don't break. His name is Woody, and oh yeah, he smokes. Parliament filters, 4 packs a day. "Filter, flavor, pack or box," he sings loudly, reminding me of the vintage ad campaign. The car stinks so bad of cigarette smoke that I'm at least sure he can't get a whiff of my rectal troubles. I used to be a heavy smoker, too. 5 packs of King Cools a day before I quit, so I can't be too judgmental. But still, he hotboxes each cigarette right down to the recessed filter and then lights the next one straight from the butt before he flicks it out the window, possibly starting a forest fire. Thank God I gave up this filthy habit or I'd be dead by now. "Want one?" he asks, holding out his pack with the parliaments arranged temptingly like the old magazine ads. "No, thank you. I quit," I politely declare. "Why would anybody quit smoking?" he rudely responds. "Because I don't want cancer," I answer smugly. "Don't you miss it?" he taunts, French inhaling even more militantly than I did in those mock no-smoking-in-this-theater announcements filmed for the Landmark Theater chain. Good God, I hate this guy, but at least we're covering some ground. We're already in Kansas when he tells me he hasn't been to sleep for 38 hours. "Let me drive, then," I offer, trying not to sound too alarmed. But no, he wants to talk about my least favorite subject, sports. "You know about the baseball curse of the Billy Goat?" he quizzes me with a newfound urge to chatter. "No, I hate sports," I explain, but he acts as if he doesn't hear me. "It's true," he shouts, blowing a big mouthful of parliament smoke in my face as if I'd argued his point. "In 1945, a Chicago Cubs fan, and I am not one of those twats," he rages, "wanted to bring some fucking Billy Goat to the World Series game." I feel like screaming. I am already so bored with this guy's dumb sports rap, but he doesn't pick up on my disinterest. Now, why did this cunt licker bring a billy goat, I ask you, he demands. I have no idea what you're talking about, I try to explain. Exactly, he hollers. Exactly what, you fool, I shriek in my mind, looking out the window into the vast nothingness of Kansas wheat fields and debating which would be worse, being reincarnated as livestock or having to listen to this colossal blowhard. But rightfully so, he continues ranting. The Wrigley Stadium security squad wouldn't let him bring this stupid billy goat on the playing field. So what does this fucker do? I refuse to participate in this meaningless conversation and instead concentrate on his burning cigarette in the ashtray. Would it hurt if I had just one, as long as it's not menthol, for old time's sake? I think of my now-gone file card in my jacket pocket, the one where I daily list my chores, plus the number of days it's been since I had a last cigarette. 3,426, if I remember correctly. Do I want to blow my near 10-year nicotine sobriety and have to start over by quitting again and writing the number one? But who can think straight when asshole Woody is still raging? This dickwad with the goat puts a curse on the Cubs, he flares up. I grab a Parliament out of the box and light it in a desperate attempt to escape this maddeningly boring conversation. One drag and my head spins. I feel faint like a teenage girl who has just lit up for the first time. No, I can feel my body yelling back at the first inhalation of cigarette smoke. But Woody's too self-absorbed to even notice. This ball sack actually curses Wrigley Field, he continues, flying off the handle. And you know what? What, I finally stammer, between reckless drags of nicotine pulsing into my bloodstream and instantly turning me into a chain smoker. What? What? I yell again, grabbing the whole pack of Parliaments out of his hands and actually eating one right out of the box, unlit. That motherfucker's curse works, Woody yells back, not at all troubled by my sobriety slippage. And there's never been a World Series game played there again, Woody spews before suddenly swerving off the highway to a rest stop. I gotta take a shit, he announces. This is one of those unmanned rest stops. No food, no gas. Just a place to go to the bathroom. I notice there seem to be a lot of cars, maybe too many. Woody charges inside, but I linger, chain-smoking and stretching my aching limbs. I notice a man who appears to be jerking off in his parked car. I look away. I figure I might as well take a leak, since my food poisoning seems to have subsided. I go inside and immediately notice there is activity, a full-scale tea room. I don't see Woody, but I can hear him still talking to himself about sports in a stall between his repellent grunts of defecation. Every urinal has a man standing in front of it, so I wait nervously. I see other guys, some obviously gay, going in and out of the stall, zipping up or down on the hunt. A guy turns away from the urinal, and I see his erect penis is still out. He gives me a lecherous grin, but I try to ignore him and take my place at one of the other urinals. The guy next to me, and he's not bad-looking either, is shaking his semi-hard dick to finish up his last drops. I try not to look. I'm never piss-shot, but suddenly I am. I break away and burst into one of the stalls, and my legs hurt so much I sit down on the toilet to piss. I don't care. I'm an injured homosexual. Suddenly I look up and see a big, uncircumcised dick poking through a glory hole. I am shocked. It is broad daylight, and we're in the middle of Kansas. Just as I jump up to flee, the door to my stall is kicked in, and an undercover cop, one of the guys I saw cruising, breaks in and flashes his badge. Vice Squad, he announces as he grabs my arm. Another cop stands on the toilet in the next booth and leans over. You're under arrest, he warns me, as he struggles to put his stiff dick back in his pants on the other side of the glory hole. For what? I plead to deaf ears as another cop, the cute one I saw shaking his dick at the urinal, rushes in from the front and with the help of the first vice cop handcuffs me. Entrapment, I yell as the other gay guys inside run from the restroom like roaches when the lights come on in a slum kitchen. I see Woody outside, still motor-mouthing about sports to the driver of an undercover cop vehicle who seems to be hanging on to his every word over the lyrics of I'm a Lone Wolf by Leon Payne blaring from the cop's radio. I used to love this song until I hear both Woody and the Vice Hog singing along mockingly to the lyrics I'm footloose and fancy free and strictly on the prowl. Woody looks over at me as if I were a stranger. Them Fruit Loops hate sports, Woody blithely informs his latest conversational victim. Serves them right. The other undercover cop dragging me out agrees. If they were just home watching the sports channel instead of sucking cock, they wouldn't be in all this trouble. The first outside cop shoves me down in the police car cage, just as in the arrest I've seen on the news. I debate telling the cop Woody's been driving without sleep for days, but don't because, well, I'm from Baltimore. I'm no snitch. We peel out and I don't believe my ears. We're in the middle of nowhere and this pig has the siren on. Is that really necessary, I ask, trying to be reasonable? As necessary as protecting families who are trying to take a dump, but can't because you Hoover mouths have turned a cleaned rest area into a sex pit, he answers with a total lack of sympathy. I didn't do one thing, I protest like Dawn Davenport. It was you guys who had your dicks out. Everything you say, he recites from memory, can and will be used against you in a court of law. Fuck, I'm going to jail? Can I have a cigarette, I plead, already jonesing a nicotine withdrawal? Didn't you read the Surgeon General's report, the cop asks unsympathetically? Smoking's bad for you, so think of a letter M, and then think of the next two letters in the alphabet and apply them. N-O spells no. Does that answer your question? Bad ride number 7. Busted in Kansas. Sodomy is illegal in Kansas, the booking officer blithely tells me as he snaps the most unflattering mugshot of me possible on their outdated police camera inside the tiny Bunker Hill County Jail. I wasn't committing sodomy, I shout. I just stopped to use the bathroom. Yeah, he responds. Look, we don't go for greedy bottoms here in the Midwest. Greedy bottoms, I yell in full horror. I don't do that. I'm all about safe sex. Safe sex is illegal sex here in the Midwest, my jailer announces with final authority. I try to change tack. Look, I'm famous. I made that movie Hairspray. With John Travolta, he smirks. No, the first one, I try to explain. With Divine. Never heard of it, but that don't matter. I hate fag musicals anyway. Look, can I call a lawyer, I ask, knowing I'm allowed one phone call? No phone service at this little old jail. It's a historic place, mostly open for tourists. Before I can challenge the blatant disregard of my legal rights, he orders me to strip down. You're kidding, I sputter. You heard me, Barks. Lose your laundry. As I slowly remove my clothes, he notices my cuts and bruises, and after seeing my hideous new tattoo, gives me a wolf whistle. I am completely mortified. I hear some hick announcer on the radio crackling in the background mention my name, and I strain to listen. Mr. Waters, the 66-year-old director of such Hollywood films as Crybaby and Hairspray, was arrested for public lewdness in a public men's room beside the highway in rural Kansas. His attorney had no comment except to say he was trying to confirm the truth of this breaking story. Lift your nuts, spread your ass cheeks, orders Ilsa, the he-wolf of Kansas, as I close my eyes, think of my Penn membership, and do as told. Bend over, he growls. He takes way too long to look. I hear Riot and Cell Block Number 9 by the Robins start to play on that same radio station, but the only riot going on here is inside my head. I stand back up in embarrassment, and he jerks me around to face him. His breath smells like licorice plaque. Next time, he snarls, maybe you won't take the Hershey Highway when you visit our great state. Before I can answer, he buzzes open a gate and shoves me inside a cell. The only cell in the tiny little rural jail. I've got a cell buddy. His name is Vernier and he's black. And he's here for a sodomy charge too, but unlike mine, he was home with his boyfriend and somebody reported suspicion of fellatio. And these rotten cops spied through his window and busted him when he and his boyfriend were giving each other head in the privacy of their own home. Knob Gobbler, the jailer introduces us. This is Mattress Muncher. We look at each other with a shared hatred of this jerk. I'm just a normal queer, confides Vernier when we're alone. Me too, I say, sort of telling the truth. Wait till you taste the food in this shithole, he warns. Chipped beef, rancid bologna, mystery meat. We can hear the clicking of the jailer's keys, and the same hog comes back in with our dinner on plastic trays. Here we go, ladies, he snorts. Time to put on the feed bag. He plops down the most disgusting meal I've ever seen in my life. Neutral loaf, explains Vernier. Don't eat it. But I'm starving, I admit, yet he's still adamant. That crap is made from rotten tomatoes, week-old moldy Wonder Bread, and the skin of tortured poultry, the opposite of free range. They keep these pitiful chickens out back in tiny little cages and torture the poor birds with electrical cattle prods until they kill themselves by hurling their skinny carcasses against the cage bars and bleed to death. Yummy, I think as I look down at my plate. I'm so starved, I eat it anyway, retching and choking from the gristle-filled texture of food hell itself. Oh, yeah, adds Veneer. They put saltpeter in it, too. Damn, just when Veneer was starting to look cute. We try to have sex during the night, but Veneer had warned me. I can't get it up and feel so frustrated when he tries to suck my dick. We try several times, and even though I'm always willing, nothing happens. That saltpeter sure is strong. Eventually, we give up and pass out, unsatisfied, on separate horrid metal bunks. The rotting Nutriloaf is never removed from our cell, and once the lights are turned off, I can hear some kind of vermin creeping around and chewing it up. I actually hear a rat puke. We are awakened by the flash of cell phone cameras. The jailer is leading a pack of sightseers on a historic tour of this renovated and restored one-time abandoned single-cell jailhouse. Here we have two obvious homosexuals, fudge packers, if you will, who invade our state every year, having illegal pricknicks in our rest areas in flagrant violation of Kansas Statute 21-3505, criminal sodomy. I only gave a blowjob, yells Veneer, in defiance as the tourists cover their ears in aural disgust. Call the Maryland Film Commission, I beg. I was doing research for my book. Skull Pussy and Pillow Biter, the jailer barks, still referring to us, the two-headed transplants of rear entry. Later in the day, we are dragged into the only other room in this tiny jailhouse, a miniature courtroom with a judge's bench and three seats for the public. I see the lowest-rent entertainment reporter I vaguely remember from some long-ago movie press junket. One of those hacks that keeps stopping the taping and demanding you call him by his first name in your responses to his extremely unoriginal questions. God, I marvel. If he's a reporter from Smoky Hills Public Television, as he claims, his career must be in real trouble. His station is based in this almost abandoned town, Bunker Hill, Kansas. Population, 95. The judge enters and he looks exactly like the cross-eyed actor who plays the biggest fascist sadist in Pasolini's movie masterpiece, Salo. Veneer gasps. I gulp. Court is now in session, our elected official announces in a flat Midwestern accent. The other two reporters, one from the faraway Wichita Times and the other from a local flea market classified giveaway sheet, are allowed to take photos while our TV guy videotapes. You two ass bandits are accused of sodomy, the judge announces without looking at us. Semen demons will not be tolerated anywhere in Kansas, plain and simple. How do you plead? Your Honor, Veneer tries to argue as his own attorney. I am constitutionally guaranteed the right to give oral sex. Overruled, the judge yells before turning to me. And you, homo hack, he rudely addresses my humble self. Judge, I have not been allowed to contact my attorney, which is a flagrant violation of my rights. You've seen too many bad movies, Cream Puff, he rules with a hint of hidden Nellyism. I suddenly realize this fucker has a little sugar in him himself. But he's not a brother, believe me. He gives us both 2 weeks of community service with the understanding that we must be out of Kansas by sunset the day our sentences end. Veneer seems relieved. But I'm not. 2 weeks? That's an eternity. I have a flight to catch from San Francisco to Provincetown for the start of the season in 8 days. 2 weeks in Bunker Hill, Kansas seems like a life sentence. Our jailer drags us out of the courtroom, and we are paraded in a perp walk before the pitiful little press corps. I ignore all their rude questions, except two. Yes, I have seen Black Mama, White Mama, and no, I do not identify with this movie in my current situation. Next stop, the same pitiful rest area where I was arrested. It's much quieter, not a pervert in sight. I guess by now the word is out that this one-time jumping tea room is now heady. Okay, the jailer announces, get out. Your job, he says to me with a smart-ass grin, is to pick up all the used rubbers you may find at this location. And you, he says to Veneer, you give out these homo health tips. I see Veneer blush, even though he's black, when he reads the Rimming and You flyer filled with graphic descriptions of various strains of hepatitis that can be caused by indiscriminate analingus. Veneer and I look at one another in militant anger, but no better than to argue. I find a stick and use it to poke through the bushes. I find a lot of used prophylactics. The semen is mostly dried up, but in some it's runny, heated up by the sun on this unfortunately warm day. I pick them up with my bare hands and deposit them in a torn Rite Aid plastic bag I find stuck blowing in the wind in a low tree branch. My jailer nods his approval. Veneer is having a much tougher time. Since most of the drivers who are stopping have to use the bathroom for legitimate purposes, they become enraged when they politely take Veneer's flyer and read the scandalous message. Some don't even know what rimming means and ask him innocently. Other men do know and are infuriated to think that they have been identified as engaging in such. One guy actually punches Veneer in the mouth. My jailer runs over to try to break it up, and I see my chance for freedom. An effeminate, bewigged older gentleman has just driven up. Back in Baltimore, we call this type a Nell box, but never to their faces. I guess he hasn't heard of the police crackdown yet. Before he can even get out to cruise, I approach him, still pretending to look for rubbers, and whisper stealthily, "Help me, I'm being held prisoner by homophobic authorities." The Nell box looks at me, over at the growing brawl with the jailer and Veneer, and then back to my crotch. "Get in, girl," he whispers in his most exaggerated old-school queen vernacular. I leap in and immediately lie on the floor. He slowly drives away. Bed ride number 8, Blossom. "Gate in my hole, Miss Thing," he whispers out of the corner of his mouth as he drives right by my jailer and poor Veneer without their even noticing I'm gone yet. "I beg your pardon," I answer, for once perplexed at the meaning of his gay slang. "I'm Blossom," this big galoot of a queen answers, not bothering to translate, "and don't you forget it, girl." Oh, God, is it wrong to be gay but still have gay shame, as it's humorously called by hip fags in the UK? Embarrassed at the old-school poofs who exaggerate the stereotype and give the new queer generation a gaily incorrect name? It's a tough call. I remember when Divine first saw Richard Simmons and confessed that he felt homophobic. I can identify here. Suddenly, Blossom reaches into the back seat and grabs a bakery box, which he hands over to me. "Have some pie, butt plug," he offers with a deranged look in his eyes. "Okay," I mutter, once again hungry after days of irregular meals. My tattoo is hurting. Every time I move, I can feel the scab stretch and break, and you can see pus leaking through my shirt in the front. "You pop your cork?" Blossom asks me with a sudden lechery when he notices. "No," I explain in horror, "I have an infection." "Well, let's stop and get some medicine," Blossom clucks like a hovering mother, suddenly pulling off Route 70 and heading south on Route 281, wherever that may lead. "Hey, I need to stay on Route 70, I cry, but he doesn't slow down. "I gotta be careful," Blossom whispers, even though it's only me in the car to hear. "Why?" I ask, almost afraid he'll confide the truth. "Can I tell you a secret, girlfriend?" he asks, and ignoring his gay familiarity, I answer warily, "Maybe you better not." "I'm on a mission, Mary," he continues, disregarding my advice. "These straight fuckers need a payback." "Who?" I ask, having no idea of what he's talking about. "Breeders," he snorts back. "Oh, come on. Some straight people are fine. These days you can't tell a person's character by his or her sexuality," I argue, not caring if he agrees or not. "Oh, yes, you fucking can," Blossom suddenly snarls with unassimilated gay fanaticism. "Somebody's gotta pay," he threatens, as we swerve off the road to enter a Rexall drugstore parking lot. Blossom pulls into a handicapped parking space and slams on the brakes in a decidedly ungirlish way. "I'm mentally handicapped because of heteros," he shouts for the world to hear, even though it's only me in the car. He opens the back door, gets out a can of spray paint, and writes, "Spaghetti is straight until you get it heated up," on the next car. First, I don't understand, but when he takes a hammer out from under the front seat and smashes the windshield of another car and snarls, "Make heterosexual divorce illegal," I begin to understand the severity of his twisted militancy. I hate separatism, but I'm too freaked out at this point to debate sexual politics. Besides, I feel dizzy. "Come on," Blossom says, dragging me out of the car and towards the drugstore. "You're coming with me." "I don't feel well," I try to explain, hoping to stall him, but telling the truth. "What's the matter with me? I feel lightheaded, nauseous, not myself." "That's because straight pig fuckers are around," Blossom rants, suddenly back to his hetero bashing. "I feel like puking, too, every time I think of them dancing the electric slide." Blossom suddenly changes the subject, all business. "Okay, once we get inside, we're just two trouser bandits out shopping." My head starts spinning in some kind of weird vertigo, and I reach out to hold on to him for support. "If we get busted," he continues, ignoring my frailties. "You don't know me, girline, and I don't know you." Suddenly, the horizon spins and I fall to my knees. My scabs, just beginning to heal, rip apart. Blossom pulls me back up to my feet with surprising strength. We both see security guards rushing to investigate Blossom's now-reported vandalism. When he gives me a wink, I realize that was Blossom's point in the first place. We enter the store. Blossom knows the layout. He heads right to the bottled water department, grabs a large bottle of Evian, looks around to see if he's being observed, unscrews the cap, takes a gulp so there's room, and pours into the bottle some Clorox bleach from a hidden container he pulls from his pocket. "Straight throat," he mutters, and even if I have no idea what he means, I know it's not good. The whole place is spinning again, and I begin to collapse, but Blossom catches me just in time. I can barely make it back to the car. Blossom, now in high spirits, is mumbling hate crime threats and giggling insanely as he sees my deteriorating condition and lets me lie down on the back seat. I feel really bad. He takes pity on me and feeds me another piece of pie. Just as the first bite goes down my throat, a light bulb goes off in my head. This freak is poisoning me too, only this time it's on purpose. I spit it out. "Why, Blossom, why?" I beg. "I'm a gay guy too." "Because you're a traitor," he hisses as he jabs on the CD player and Strychnine by the Sonics comes on. I usually love this kind of music, but the lyrics, "I like the taste of straight strychnine," are suddenly not funny. "You're a bisexual sympathizer and assimilated faggot," Blossom continues. "Worse yet, you're not an outlaw anymore." I vaguely remember stopping at two more convenience stores. He went in alone while I lay helpless in the back seat. First, it was a Hy-Vee drugstore where he replaced milk of magnesia with Ipecac so they can feel as sick as I do when I see straight guys sitting in a movie theater together with one empty seat between them so their legs won't accidentally touch. My memory is foggy on the last one, but I think it was someplace named Cheapo Depot, right over the Oklahoma border, where he injected citrus fruit with rat poison. If leather bars are vanishing, so must straight people. I finally lose consciousness. It's early morning when I wake up. I'm in some sort of adult hotel with Blossom. Pay-per-view bareback gay porn is playing on the TV. He's completely nude with an erection, and his legs are up and wrapped around his head. His asshole is so overused, it resembles a baboon's. Blossom. Now I know where he got his name. He's tied a noose around his neck and strung it tight over the faux rafter overhead, all ready to be sprung. He's obviously an autoerotic asphyxiation enthusiast. Stroking his enlarged cock, he has been waiting for me to wake up and focus on this full horror show. "Gay to my hole, Miss Thing," he announces for the second time today. And this time, I think I know what he means. He snaps the cord, and the rope flips him around to his feet and hoists him off the ground. He chokes in ecstasy. Maybe he reaches an orgasm. I'm not sure. I run. Bed Ride Number 9, Captain Jack. It's fucking boiling outside already, and Natch, without my bag, I don't have my sunblock or my baseball hat. And Beaver, Oklahoma is not exactly a hotbed of shopping choices. I stand in the rising sun for a long time. No cars come by. I feel old with my infected tattoo, my achy legs, and a general fatigue from the anxiety of cross-country hitchhiking that has gone so wrong. The sun gets hotter, and I can feel my bald spot burning. I find an old piece of cardboard by the side of the road, and I hold it over my head. But every time I reach my arms up, my tattoo scabs seem to rip and pull apart. I'm thirsty. Jesus, I see some sort of bird overhead. I hope it's not a buzzard anticipating more bad luck for me. I'm not roadkill. I am a man. Captain Jack is beyond a doubt the most disgusting-looking driver who has picked me up so far. But after several hours of waiting with bleeding sunburn blisters, you'll get in any car, believe me. He is of indeterminate age, maybe even younger than me, but the years have not been kind. Grizzled worse than Gabby Hayes and smelling stronger than the comic strip character B.O. Plenty, Captain Jack also is a goiter sufferer. He has a huge, hideous one on his neck. I have always feared catching a goiter from a stranger, and have voiced such concerns to my assistants in the past, but they just hooted and hollered, "That is medically impossible." I'm not so sure. At first, I think the clinging, pungently damp, and horrendous stench in his car is his breath. But then I realize it is goiter odor. Every time he speaks, his repulsive growth rises, falls, and quivers in thyroid hormone starvation. Captain Jack claims to be a recycler, but he sure ain't green. He's a hoarder of unrecyclable plastic. The entire interior of his car is filled with dirty deli trays, old number four prepared food containers, filthy plastic cups, and moldy takeout containers. This is the first car I have ever been in where I notice roaches. Captain Jack doesn't talk much, but God, he stops his vehicle a lot. At every rest area, manned or unmanned, he pulls over, roots through the trash, and rescues plastic orphans, as he calls the unwanted, inorganic children of our garbage. I could run and try to get another ride, but he's going all the way to Colorado Springs, a good distance, and he's at least a safe driver. Besides, the families in Oklahoma don't look friendly. Not one person has recognized me. But by now, without my eyebrow pencil or little scissors, who could? My pencil-thin mustache is in piss-poor shape. You can't see it now unless you're up close, and the odor zone of infection of my tattoo keeps any potential mustache viewer safely at a distance. Captain Jack has little friends in his car, too. It takes me a while to notice Janice, who he introduces as his wife, who's made out of plastic rings from carry-out six-packs and some coat hanger wire twisted together in some kind of torso with a head fashioned out of an empty paint can with a wig on top made from food-stained paper napkins. He has children, too. Myrtle, a baby girl sculpted entirely out of food scraps, who he confides has disabilities and rests in a discarded and burned kitchen pot some poor, fired, short-order cook forgot and left on a burning stove. His son, Arnold, could be considered outsider art by some, I imagine. He's lovingly formed out of broken beer bottles with an ugly little face painted on with spilled kitchen messes from soiled paper towels. It's not right the state of Oklahoma rejects these unwanted little recyclables, he begins ranting before asking me with true bewilderment. Why should a tin can feel superior to a takeout container? Junk mail is okay to be picked up, while plastic wrap is rejected? How could that not be called discrimination? Well, I try to reason, those are inanimate objects. They're not human, so their feelings can't be hurt. That's what you think, he suddenly rages. I'm tired of aluminum cans feeling uppity around styrofoam cups. They're all equal. Waste and recycling, I argue, are gray areas still being worked out by environmentalists. In California, many of these items you have in your car are recyclable. It just costs more to do so. That really sets him off. States' rights? Is that what you're arguing? He debates with an unhinged passion. Why does Oklahoma get off the hook? Why should a salad bar container be trash in this state and a valuable citizen in California? He screams, his goiter going up and down with each rant. It is a federal case. Spray aerosol cans are fucking better than dirty tinfoil, he yells, banging the steering wheel on every other word. How could that be? Somebody's got to stick up for takeout containers. Plastic bottle supremacists will not be tolerated. I watch with growing alarm as his goiter turns deep red, then purple, and finally almost black. Suddenly, his goiter explodes. Not only am I covered in a thin coat of pus, but so is he. Oh, my God. I pray I haven't caught goiter germs. See, Captain Jack shouts in agony to me. See what recycling discrimination can do to a man. Much to my relief, Captain Jack continues driving safely, despite the fact that the steering wheel is also covered with slime from his exploded growth. In a panic, I turn on the radio without asking permission, and I'm relieved to hear that incredibly beautiful, melancholic, Lonesome Drifter by Jericho Brown playing. But Captain Jack scowls at the lyric, "Ain't Got No Loved Ones," because he believes otherwise. "I'm sorry, Janice," he sobs to his recycled wife, flicking off the radio in contempt. "I've tried to be a garbage integrationist," he explains to his spouse, "but society fights me every step of the way." "Change takes time," I soothe him, but he doesn't even hear me. He's in another world by now, a recycled state of mind. "Arnold, Myrtle," he blubbers, completely ignoring my human presence. "I have never refused refuse, have I?" They don't answer as far as I can tell, but he seems unfazed. "I don't waste, do I?" he continues to plead to his pitiful little family of garbage talismans, and somehow he seems solaced by their silence. All I know is that I feel a little bump on my neck, and at first I think it's just my imagination. When I grab the rearview mirror over so I can look, I almost don't recognize myself. I appear so exhausted and weary. And no, it's not just my lunacy. I do have something growing, and it's no pimple. I can't wait to tell Susan and Trish they were wrong. I knew it. Goiters are contagious. Garbage diversity is a right, Captain Jack continues crusading without the slightest notice of my goiter concern. The skin around his erupted neck volcano is hanging in flaps, its hole in the center gaping in expulsion. Yet he's suddenly upbeat on a new role, but I don't even listen. I'm too worried about this thing right below my Adam's apple. Maybe it's just acne, some kind of callus caused by the sun, even a tumor. But please, God, anything but a goiter. I'm coming, little babies, Captain Jack shouts to the residents of the next trash can as we pull in, unscheduled, to yet another rest area. I know that we're near Colorado Springs, and while I'm quite aware the city has a formidable conservative reputation, I did have a show there once at the Colorado Springs Fine Arts Center. Maybe they would give me some help. But then I remember my new outgrowth. Could the art mob ever accept me now? I run, but it's hard with this fucking thing flapping on my neck. Captain Jack looks up from picking through the filthy, bee-ridden, overripe trash and holds up a large bunch of rusted, discarded wire coat hangers. See, he screams to me in the distance. See how cruel people are? I stick out my thumb. But who on earth is going to pick me up when I'm featuring a fresh goiter puckering on my neck for the whole world to see? Bed ride number 10, Bristol. Bristol, that's who. I get in and immediately regret my decision to not just jump out and run. She's a slightly butch Grace Metellius lookalike, dressed in that same red checkered shirt the novelist wore in her Peyton Place author photo, and the same greasy ponytail to boot, and has the heat inside her van turned up full blast despite the outside temperature of 75 degrees. A dead dog is in the back seat, and the rest of the vehicle is loaded with cages filled with snarling canines in all states of ill health. She is an animal rescuer. The problem is, no one asked her to rescue these animals. She just felt like the chosen one. Bristol started her own doggy underground, where she would kidnap animals from kill shelters or other atrocity centers, such as bankrupt pet stores, puppy mills, or even homes of pet owners reported by other furry friend lovers who supposedly didn't spend enough time with their animals. Some had daytime jobs, which was totally unacceptable to Bristol. Even being involved in a love relationship with another human being was animal cruelty, in her opinion. Bristol actually looks kind of like a dog herself. Not an ugly one, just a plain dog, elongated chin, large ears, and a nose that seems to be sniffing for something she will never find. As soon as she pulls off, a cat leaps from out of nowhere and bites me right on my tender goiter. Ow! I scream in both pain and surprise. Don't mind catnip, Bristol says with a smirk. She's got ringworm. Oh, perfect. I'm trapped with an insane pet kidnapper in a car that smells like the worst cage in the zoo, and she's got a cat who is giving off bad vibes about me to the other animals in the car. I can see catnip mewing some lie about me to a dog, and I know that sounds like paranoia, but it's true. All pets hate me. Oh, he won't hurt you, pet owners coo to me when they see my fear. Heal, I always shout to the animal, but it never seems to work. Their pets do try to bite me. Even goldfish seem hostile when they get a glimpse of my frightened face through the bowl. I don't hate animals. I just have no desire to touch one. I'm not lonely. But before you call PETA, let me explain. I think all dogs should be off leashes biting people. That's what they want to be doing, running in packs like the wild canines I saw in Bucharest that seem so happy to attack you, snarling and yapping when you get out of a cab. Dogs don't want to be home with their owners, stuck in some sort of sick S&M relationship, sentenced to a lifetime of human caresses. How would you like to take a shit with someone following you around waiting to pick it up with a plastic newspaper bag? Talk about humiliating. Also, I hate to tell you this, but can't you see? Your cat hates you. But naturally, I don't tell Bristol any of this because I can see she is one of those maniacs who supposedly love animals but always seems to hate people. Snake bite your neck? She asks rudely. No, I seem to have developed some kind of goiter, I weakly try to explain. Suddenly, as if cued by Lucifer himself, the dogs in their cages all begin to bark, and Bristol swerves to miss something in the road. I look back and see a mangy dog eating the roadkill of a fox that has obviously been flattened by a speeding vehicle. Her dogs inside the car start wailing in pack mentality. Bristol pulls over, jumps from the car, and grabs some sort of animal tranquilizer gun from the trunk. God knows what else she's got in there because I stay inside the car. But her dogs wail in agonized excitement at the possible pet drama. I watch Bristol in amazement as she coaxes the insane-looking animal away from his maggot-infested lunch by barking and growling herself in some sort of faux-dog communication. Suddenly, Bristol fires the dart from the gun like a seasoned veterinarian. The rabid dog flips over and goes limp immediately. The other dogs in the car let out growls of approval, and Bristol barks back in dog celebration. She drags the unconscious dog over and, much to my shock, throws it in the front seat with me. I can see the stringy shreds of putrefied fox meat still caught in the beast's teeth. Oh, my God, I hear Bristol cry out, suddenly speaking in English. The poor creature hasn't been neutered. Well, at least she's not pro-life, I think, in the only optimistic moment of the ride. We'll fix that, she announces with sudden purpose. To my utmost horror, I see her grab a box cutter from the glove compartment, flip over the mutt's limp body, and slit the skin by the testicles. I look away in horror. Watch this, she orders, or you can walk to San Francisco. I sheepishly turn my eyes back. One day you may have to do this yourself, she sternly warns, like some kind of veterinarian leader. I doubt that, I want to scream, but then look ahead to the empty highway and keep my mouth shut. Like a skilled surgeon working on the battlefield, she ligates the testicles and closes up the incision surgically with a pitiful stapler and a tube of superglue. I guess the operation is a success because Bristol pulls away and all her dogs start barking, almost in song, like that horrible version of Jingle Bells recorded by the singing dogs. I can't tell what the new dog song is, but Bristol starts barking along with them, too, so I just sit there, musically alone, with my scabs itching, my sunburn peeling, my tattoo oozing, and my goiter throbbing. Then I see that fucking cat again eyeing me as it pukes up fur balls or something on the floor. Bristol doesn't seem to notice. It looks as if she suddenly has digestive problems of her own. Bristol starts gagging. The cat is retching, and what comes out looks worse than fur. I turn to Bristol in alarm, but she signals me with her hands that she's okay. But she's not. She keeps driving and at the same time starts frantically gesturing for me to get something from under my seat. She can't talk because she's retching and heaving, so I frantically reach under and find a glass bottle of milk. Bristol starts shaking her head in affirmation, and I take off the bottle cap and hand it to her. But instead of chugging it down, she holds it just outside her mouth and opens wide. Nothing happens at first, but then I think I see something white dart out of her mouth and then go right back in. The dogs go berserk in the cages. The cat starts hissing and making ungodly noises. Suddenly, I see the white head of a tapeworm poke out from her mouth again, drawn by the bait of the milk. Bristol grabs the head of the tapeworm as quick as lightning and starts pulling it out of her throat through her mouth. The cat's back goes up in a hump, and it pukes its own load of tapeworms. But Bristol doesn't give up. She keeps pulling the tapeworm up from the bowels of her gullet, gagging and choking, heaving and spewing phlegm, until finally the tail is disgorged. I watch in complete horror. Bristol, suddenly calm, heaves the carcass of the now-dead tapeworm out the window. The dogs quiet down. I kick off some regurgitated worm remains from my boots, my good boots that I paid a pretty penny for. We pull into Bristol's forever home, her animal sanctuary surrounded by chain-link fencing outside Grand Junction, Colorado. It's night. She offers me a place to stay, and what can I say? I have no money or credit cards or phone. This will have to do. I see thousands of dogs everywhere, a new circle of hell. Her car comes to a stop, and the outside canines go wild to see their leader, jumping up on the hood of her car, licking the windshield, jumping up to the side window, snarling at me in jealousy. I am terrified, but see that the cat is completely nonchalant. When Bristol steps out of the car, all the dogs immediately go silent but begin slurping her everywhere on her body with slavish adoration. Some lick her on the lips. Others actually lap her shoes. It's truly sickening. I relock the doors, but Bristol opens them back up with her key ring remote and tells me it's fine. Since she is now covered in dog slobber, which she makes no move to clean up, I'm not sure what fine is. I slowly get out of the vehicle, and thank God the dogs don't attack. They just watch me with the same cold rage the birds had for Tippi Hedren at the end of that Hitchcock movie. Bristol releases her dogs from the cages in the car, and they are immediately welcomed by other snarling packs of frightened mongrels. I am especially unnerved to see the unconscious, now neutered dog begin to come to and then with a rabid ferocity leap right past me to join his fellow curs in pack rule. Bristol smiles in animal lunacy. The infected cat jumps out of the front seat, and Bristol takes a dead mouse out of her purse and flips it in the air directly to the puss's mouth. I thought a cat wouldn't eat an already dead mouse, but I guess I was wrong. My hostess asks me if I'm hungry, and I stupidly say yes. You'd think by now I'd realize that she eats the same food scraps her animals do and expects me to do the same. I'm so hungry, I eat them. When it's time for Betty Bye, she walks me out back and points to a doghouse. It's a human-sized one, so I don't complain. Just as I'm about to close my eyes in exhaustion, the overhead clouds part and a full moon shines through. Thousands of dogs howl. I'm not exactly sure, but I think I hear Bristol join in. Bed ride number 11. Hogwash. I get up early, out of the doghouse for real. Luckily, I still remember what direction is west. Please, dear God, get me out of Colorado. My goiter has actually subsided a little. Real scabs have formed on all my injuries. The certain tightness of nature's healing invites picking, but I know better. Even my tattoo has stopped oozing, so can I take that as some sort of good sign? I guess not. I stand there at an entrance ramp to Route 70 West, my aorta of misery, for hours. Knowing better, but at a loss for a better plan, I walk down to the highway and give it a try, but alas, it's worse. Cars do come by, but by now I'm looking really rough. Nobody even glances towards me, much less slows down to consider picking me up. I walk for a mile or two, and then a miracle. I see a partially crushed, run-over felt-tip marker by the side of the road. Again, I pray. Please, God, let it work. I unscrew the cap and test it on my hand. Thank the Lord above, it's not dried out. I scan the area for anything to make a sign out of, but see nothing. I continue walking and glimpse part of a cardboard box that has blown from somewhere caught in a storm drainage ditch. Maybe heaven itself? I scramble over the brush and grab the potential hitchhike sign like the lifeboat it may be. In desperation, I write out in big, bold letters, "Help, I made hairspray." On the flip side, over the logo of some generic paper towel label, I am even more shameless and scrawl, "I'm John Waters." It doesn't work. Hours more go by. Out of boredom, I walk more. Still no dice. Cars, trucks, vans, they all ignore me and my sign. Finally, a motorcycle stops. My one rule, never get on a motorcycle while hitchhiking. This guy wears the colors of the Sundowners, a biker club I am unfamiliar with. But God knows he looks like the real thing, almost like the Hell's Angels, which makes me feel warm and fuzzy because I'm a real sucker for these guys. Well, not literally, because they're all old now. I know you're never supposed to say the words Hell's Angels out loud unless you are one of them, and I try to respect this outsider law. I agree with Quentin Crisp, who called Hell's Angels naturally superior beings. They are. I genuflect to their infamy. I've met some of the Maryland Angels in Baltimore and once took two of them to the Auto Bar, a great punk rock club in town. You should have seen the face.